From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The past year has been tough on everyone, but among mental health professionals, there's extra concern about children. Here in New Hampshire, the state reported last week that the children's wait list for psychiatric beds is at historic levels. And even among those kids who aren't in crisis, many are struggling with loneliness, isolation, and anxiety. Today in The Exchange, it's part two of our series, Taking a Toll, about the mental health impacts of the past year. And this hour, we focus on children and how they're doing emotionally. We'll also share lots of resources and advice. Our conversation begins today with New Hampshire's kid governor, Charlie Olson, a fifth grader at Auburn Village School. He's made shedding light on childhood depression the focus of his term, and we caught up with Charlie last week. And Charlie Olson joins us right now. He's New Hampshire's newest kid governor. And Charlie, it's really great to meet you. Thank you for being on The Exchange today.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Why did you decide to run for kid governor, Charlie?
Well, during the quarantine, I became depressed. And my parents decided that to have a friend over because I was becoming so depressed. And I recovered from depression. So I knew if it worked for me, it would work for other kids too.
What did that feel like for you, Charlie, when all of a sudden you went from being a regular 10-year-old kid to being shut up at home? And you've been very open about, you know, your depression. But what did that feel like?
Well, I would cry myself to sleep at night, and I was afraid to talk about it because of the stigma. It was just a deep sadness that, like, I couldn't get over. Like, we'd be doing something super fun, and it wouldn't be fun to me. It would feel the same.
What's the stigma? Why is it hard to talk about depression when you're a kid?
Well, it's you're afraid people make fun of you, and it's also just you don't want to talk about it. Like, I remember when I was depressed, I just didn't want to talk about it. And also I was kind of afraid of, like, what they'd say if I did say something.
Wow. What did you fear that they would say? And by they, I'm guessing you mean friends, teachers, parents, whoever.
I was just kind of afraid of, like, they'd say, like, depression, you're a wimp, you're depressed. Or, like, they'll make fun of me, kind of. But that's not what I want people to do. Like, I want people to support people that are being depressed. And they don't have to be afraid to talk about it.
Who did you talk to about first, Charlie, when you really just thought, okay, I am tired of being deeply sad all the time?
Well, so one time my mom was tucking me in at night, and I asked her, is this what depression feels like? And she said, I think so. So I guess it was my parents.
So as kid governor, what's the plan? What's the plan to help other children manage or fight their depression?
Well, this is one of them, having people know that you're not afraid to talk about it and know that it's okay to feel depressed. Also, I want to make a group where people can email me saying that they're feeling sad or depressed, and then I can have a kid or a friend, maybe even in their school, talk to them or Zoom in with them and help, like, kind of be like their mentor and help them. And also make a positivity network where people can share positivity with one another.
Wow, that sounds great. Adults could use a positivity network too, I think. So that's a really good idea. If there's any children listening right now who are struggling with their mental health, who are feeling the way that you felt, you know, just sad all the time and nothing was giving you pleasure, what's your message to them, Charlie?
Well, you don't have to be afraid to talk about it, and it's okay to be depressed, and I want to help you. You can feel sad and depressed. You don't have to be ashamed that you're depressed. It's just, you just can't be afraid to talk about it. And also, you can talk to friends. You can talk to family members. They'll support you and help you recover, and it'll be okay.
Anything else you want to say, Charlie, about what you hope to do in this, you know, year of being kid governor?
Well, I have, even after I'm governor, I'm still going to be doing stuff to help with depression and the stigma associated with it.
Charlie, thank you for being here. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
That's Charlie Olson, New Hampshire's kid governor. He's a fifth grader from Auburn. And listeners, join us. How are your kids doing right now in terms of mental health? What emotions are they feeling? How's your household trying to manage that? What help do they need? What help do you need? Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or call 800-892-6477. Also, the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. And that number is on our website as well. Our guests for the hour are Erin Barnett. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Geisel School of Medicine and works for Dartmouth Hitchcock. Erin sees patients at West Central Behavioral Health in Lebanon. And Erin, a big welcome. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Ritu Chatterjee. She's health correspondent with NPR. She's been focusing on mental health. And Ritu, thank you very much for being here as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And also with us, Dr. Nicole Christian Brathwaite, a psychiatrist and the CEO and founder of Well Minds Consulting Company in Boston. And Dr. Christian, welcome back. It's good to have you again.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Well, Ritu, I'll start with you since you've been covering this nationally. What are the numbers? What does the research, Ritu, tell us broadly about how American kids are doing right now?
So I'll start with a report that the CDC put out last fall, Laura, that showed that one of the ways how kids are doing emotionally is kind of showing up is in hospital emergency departments. And what they found is that since the lockdown in March of last year, there's been a relative rise in the number of kids showing up in hospital ERs in mental health crises. And some hospitals that I've talked to around the country, and I think I've talked to providers in about 8 states, they told me that during the fall of 2020, not just the relative number of kids compared to other patients, but the absolute number of kids in mental health crisis was way higher than the same time of year in 2019. So kids coming up with suicide, you know, showing up to the hospitals, having attempted suicide or really having a plan and seriously considering suicide, kids with eating disorders, kids with behavioral issues, you know, where they're acting out a lot. Then you have kids with just depression, anxiety, and sort of this range of emotional crises. So that's one way that, you know, I think psychiatrists and healthcare providers are seeing just what a big toll it's the pandemic has taken on kids.
Wow. And I've also it's pretty been sobering. Talking, yeah, go ahead, Ritu. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been talking to school counselors. I've been talking to psychiatrists who are both in hospitals, but also working with schools. And schools are also very concerned about this. I've been collaborating with our education desk. My colleague Corey Turner and I have been working on some stories on this. I'm a station reporter in Illinois, Christine Herman. And they've been talking to parents. I've been talking to parents as well. And I think one group of kids who are particularly struggling right now, based on sort of personal stories and what child and adolescent psychiatrists and psychologists tell us, is kids with pre-existing mental health issues or even physical health issues. So what's happened there is that once, once the pandemic happened, in-person outpatient services sort of closed down, many of these kids used to get services and support at school, and school went virtual, so that a lot of that in-person support kind of disappeared. And then, you know, all the stresses of the pandemic, sort of adjusting to virtual schooling, not seeing your friends, missing out on events, and just stress about, just the economic toll of the pandemic has affected so many families. So families are stressed out, right? People have lost jobs.
And kids feel the stress from their parents.
Absolutely.
It kind of trickles down. I want to hear from Dr. Christian, too. Since you're seeing patients, Dr. Christian, what's the picture that you're getting from children and families?
I essentially agree. The volume of calls that I receive every week has increased significantly, as well as the number of children and patients who are really struggling and are in crisis. And unfortunately, because of COVID, the already limited supply of supports for children in terms of inpatient mental health beds or intensive outpatient programs have decreased because of the need for social distancing and the reduced number of children. So we often see children spending days sitting in the hallways of hospital emergency rooms because there really aren't beds available for treatment. And so many psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, and child therapist, we're trying to find creative ways to support our patients and their families because the resources are so limited.
What are some of those creative ways? I'm interested in that, Dr. Christian.
Sure. So one big change is the adoption of telepsychiatry more broadly.
Right.
I also work for a telepsychiatry company called Array Behavioral Care. And most therapists, if not many therapists and child psychiatrists, have had to move to telepsychiatry. So in some ways, it's positive because it allows for more flexibility for families. I can see kids in their homes. I get to meet pets and siblings. I get tours of their home. I get to see their room. So in some ways, I have a better connection with some of my patients because of telepsychiatry. And rather than having to leave school early and travel to my office, the kids can take less time out of their school day. And so telepsychiatry has certainly spread globally and has become much more available. And realistically, it probably will be here to stay for many people. But then also, how do you use telepsychiatry with a seven-year-old? And thinking about how to engage in play therapy with seven-year-olds, and how do we engage with adolescents who are tired of being on Zoom all day? And so figuring out creative ways to engage patients, like literally sharing my screen and playing video games with some of my adolescents as a way to engage them. Or one of my patients, they have a Barbie, I have a Barbie, and we play together. And instead of sitting on a floor in my office, we engage in play therapy via Zoom. And so that's certainly been one aspect.
Wow. And I've, you know, heard of child therapists, you know, playing games, playing with blocks and so forth. But did you ever think, Dr. Christian, when you got into this field that you'd be playing video games online with your patients? So, but you're right. Teenagers do connect over these games and they do talk about stuff. Sometimes the game kind of takes away, the focus on the game takes away from the scariness of the subject matter. Erin, tell us what ages of kids you see, and also how would you define what your patients are going through right now?
Sure. Hi, I'm a child psychologist. I see all ages, as young as two, with attachment and trauma models, up to 18. So in our community mental health center, we pivoted right away to telehealth. So we didn't disrupt services. We never closed down, which was great. And I think that was the beauty of Northern New England, in our rural communities. We weren't seeing as much crisis from COVID patients. So that was great. Although the community may not have known that we were still open, which was part of the problem. And, you know, we're seeing high stress levels, high levels of crises, not across the board. You know, there are a few who did okay in this virtual world, but overall, it's been incredibly stressful. And most important is the parent stress. Because our children absorb their stress, their, you know, sharpness, they're a little more harsh, or they're just incredibly anxious. Again, in rural New Hampshire, our major crisis, in my opinion, has been the mental health and social crisis rather than, you know, actual people getting sick and dying. We've been so blessed because we're so rural and because we've done a really good job around safety. But everything's still locked down and shut down. So we saw a huge crises in the spring in particular. And then I noticed in the summer, our rates were really low in the summer in our community. And, you know, sunlight and getting outside really helped a lot of people. And then schools, by and large, reopened in the fall. Some of them were hybrid. But by and large, kids were getting in part-time or full-time. And that really helped. I mean, moods, again, increased even more. And parents got a little relief. Particularly if schools open full time, parents got a little relief and were able to work. There's been a huge, huge problem. It's a big gender issue with moms having to cut hours, lose jobs, et cetera, to be at home when the kids are remote or partially remote. And again, that just really gets absorbed by the kids. So I've seen a lot of acting out, a lot of increases in what we call externalizing behaviors, and some internalized, like Charlie was describing, a more internalized symptom, a symptom cluster of sort of being depressed and sad and weepy. But a lot of kids show their upset and their stress and their depression through acting out. So they're fighting with their siblings, they're oppositional towards their parents, they're not getting outside, they're not getting exercise, they're bouncing off the walls, and
yeah,
stress
and they're
levels
all
are
stuck
really
together.
High.
And you're all together, so you don't get a break from each other, really. That was what was good about the summer. It was a really nice summer, so people were able to at least get out. You know, since you mentioned moms largely taking up sort of the burden of kids being at home, we got this email from Michelle who says, "Last spring, my husband and I worked more hours than ever, and in the office. That meant our 14-year-old son was home by himself for 12 to 13 hours a day. The isolation took a toll on his mental health. Despite being in healthcare, I was too overwhelmed and overworked to see the crisis unfolding in my own home." Michelle says it came to a head in May. My son had an emotional breakdown, and in the same week, a student in his grade took his own life. I was rattled, not just because I had failed to see my son's struggles, but also because I knew this would be a long haul, despite the school reopenings. I decided in May to leave my job. Like many women, my husband's job paid more, so it made the most financial sense for our family for me to be the one to stay home. Having me at home, combined with the counseling we were able to get him, has made a tremendous difference for my son. Thank you so much for writing in, Michelle. I think that's a common story happening in a lot of families. Jenna also wrote in on our coronavirus survey. Jenna says, "I feel for the kids who are struggling with remote learning, the ones who really need the in-person instruction. What directly impacts me, of course, is my kids' mental well-being. They are both in pivotal years and will be missing out on a lot of things before they transition into their next schools. And I feel bad they will be missing out on these rites of passage." Jenna, thank you for writing. And Dr. Christian, if you could address that too, you know, even for the kids who aren't in crisis, like Michelle's son, like the kids who you guys are seeing getting admitted into emergency rooms, there is this sort of grieving for those rites of passage. You know, you grow up watching the older kids, you know, have their senior prom or go away to summer camp, and you can't do that.
Right. Absolutely. And grief is a great way to describe it. And when we think about the stages of grief, going through denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, if we look at our children, they've been going through stages of grief. If we really reflect on what our children have lost, prom, sports, senior activities, independence, socialization, even a lot of the distractions that they used for coping skills, they've lost. So hanging out with friends for a lot of kids is how they cope with stress, or going to the movies, or just going out to eat with friends. All of those things have been lost. And so it's very important that when we're thinking about how our kids are doing, that we really validate their struggles, and that we encourage them to accept their frustration and those negative emotions. And also to recognize that when we're thinking about the stages of grief, it's not a linear process. You can be in denial one day, and then the next day you kind of are accepting it. And then the next day you're very angry and frustrated. And so even as adults, we go through these stages of grief throughout the day, throughout the week, because this has been such a prolonged experience. And for many kids, it feels like it's never ending. And so it is important that we acknowledge and affirm how they're feeling, but also encourage them and focus on some of the things that they can control, rather than just allowing them to focus on the things that are out of their control.
Yeah, that's an important point, isn't it, Dr. Christian? So give us a little more there, please, saying, yes, this stinks. Yes, this is awful. But what can you do?
Exactly. So when we think about trauma or loss, one of the big parts of that is feeling hopeless or helpless. And when we feel hopeless or helpless, that tends to breed depression, anxiety, feeling more discouraged. And one of the things that we can do is finding even small things that our kids can change, helping them feel like they have some agency over their lives. So whether or not it's having them create their own schedule, helping them determine what their day looks like. So outside of school, what are we doing? What can you control? What within our home can we control? How can you control your communication with friends? Maybe you can have social distance outdoor experiences, or schedule Zoom calls, or schedule video game opportunities where you're both on at the same time. And also focusing on our kids' strengths. Like I have patients, their strength is Minecraft. And so when we meet, I ask them to teach me Minecraft because I know that's their strength. And confidence breeds confidence, and success breeds success. So we have to give our kids opportunities to feel empowered, to feel in control. And again, it can be as small as on Wednesdays, you make dinner, and that's your day, and we rely on you and we support you, and you are so great at making spaghetti. And so that child feels empowered that this is what I can do on Wednesdays.
Well, Dr. Christian, Erin, Ritu, let's go to our callers. And Lindsay's calling in from Keene. Lindsay, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura. I take it you can hear me.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, good morning. So great topic. So this has been something that's been on my mind for quite a while as an educator, social worker, mental health worker. I've been in the schools, I've homeschooled, I've been in private schools, public schools. And one of the things that I don't seeing being addressed, and if they are, please forgive me because I missed it, is that when are we going to start looking at our curriculum? I don't remember the young man's name, if it was Charlie, but Charlie, for him to be in that position, what a courageous young man, I love him. But what about if in first grade we begin to normalize it? You know, we begin to talk about, we always talk about our family histories, right? How about, oh, what are the challenges in your family history? Well, we have diabetes, well, we have heart disease, well, we have mental illness. And have the kids, how many people have families with mental illness, you know, and we start talking about it and we normalize it. To me, we could do so much for that. And I also feel like it would help with the educators. There are a lot of teachers, educators, mental health workers that I've worked with that have never done any personal work on their own issues. You know, we all need to be able to talk about it. And I'm not going to say any more because I'm very passionate about it and I'll go on too long.
Well, it's really good to hear from you, Lindsay. And Ritu, I think I'll turn to you, the idea that, and she loves what Charlie said, of talking more about it and normalizing it at younger ages. Go ahead, Ritu.
Yeah, so that is really important. And I think from the reporting that I've done so far, what I'm hearing is that schools, especially during the pandemic, I think many schools were already sort of working on it. But I think what the pandemic has done is force schools to recognize that this is, whether they like it or not, even though their main goal is education, they are, you know, a source of social, emotional support. And I think a lot of schools, again, maybe not enough of them, are starting to think about how do, especially as many schools are reopening or thinking about reopening soon, they're starting to think about how do I support our kids, especially those who've been through particularly hard time. You know, we're talking about grief, kids who've been exposed to trauma, have lost family members, or they're grieving, you know, just everything that's happened in the past year. I think schools are starting to think about it. And in many cases, I'm hearing of mental health professionals collaborating, even children's hospitals, psychiatrists at children's hospitals, collaborating with schools, supporting them, giving teachers and staff basic training on social emotional learning and emotional well-being so that they can kind of be more aware of what their students are going through and make room to talk about these things.
Just, you know, like, so Charlie, I think, said, yeah,
exactly. Talk about them.
Lindsay, thank you very much for calling in. We have to take a quick break, but I do want to remind listeners as we head into the break, we have lots of mental health resources, advice, phone numbers, websites for kids and their families. So check out our web post for today's show. It's nhpr.org/exchange. We also have that national suicide hotline number there as well. So lots on the web post today, nhpr.org/exchange. And our conversation continues in just a moment. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
A few things have changed since NHPR first began as Granite State Public Radio back in 1981.
We welcome WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire to the NPR and All Things Considered family.
But through it all, local listener support has made this station possible. And for a limited time, we'll send you a classic canvas tote featuring the retro Granite State Public Radio logo when you become an NHPR sustainer at the discounted rate of $13 a month. But don't wait. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's the second in our series, Taking a Toll, about the mental health impacts of the past year. This hour, we're focusing on children. And listeners, let's hear from you. If you're a parent or someone who works with kids, how do you see them doing right now? If you're a young person yourself, how are you managing emotionally? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Erin Barnett, an assistant professor of psychiatry who sees patients at West Central Behavioral Health in Lebanon, Ritu Chatterjee, NPR's health correspondent, and Dr. Nicole Christian Brathwaite, a psychiatrist and CEO and founder of Well Minds Consulting. And Erin, to you, before we get into sort of resources and advice, especially given the huge shortage of therapists available for kids these days, what do you think, Erin, what sort of general factors might predict which kids are managing okay emotionally, maybe not great, but okay, and which kids are really struggling? Are there demographic factors that you're looking at, Erin?
Certainly. And again, it all comes down, a lot of it comes down to family stress, right? So what resources does the family have? What amounts of stress are they under? And families with poverty, families who lost jobs, families who are struggling with mental health, we're really seeing that in the children. So there's a large disparity in social class and resources across different communities and across different families. We've noticed again this toll on mothers, and our research is showing that also. The women are drinking more or using more. We've still had incredibly high numbers, rates of overdose in our community. So we're seeing that, and our kids are certainly feeling that. The families, the kids, some have natural resiliency factors, right? They're hopeful, they're optimistic, they're free from depression, anxiety, and they're good at something, they can master something, they have efficacy. Those are all really good protective factors. Supportive extended family, supportive social circles, even if it's virtual, faith communities, again, protective factors. We know a lot about just getting humans outside into sunlight, getting humans exercise, are incredible, easy, quote unquote easy, if you're not depressed and anxious, to get some boosts to our mood and to lift our spirits. Those are some simple ways. Harder in New Hampshire, a long winter, it can be trouble. And again, if you don't have those resources, you can't buy, really warm gloves. You can't run to the store and get toe warmers. You can't afford snow pants. Everything makes it harder. And so there's just, we're just seeing these big disparities in those who have and have not.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's easy to say, Erin, get outside, but if it's freezing cold and you don't have snow pants, you get wet and cold pretty quickly. I wonder also what differences, Erin, you might be seeing between your male and female young patients. Charlie Olson, who we heard from earlier, said he was at first afraid that his friends would make fun of him.
Yeah, little Charlie was pretty articulate, wasn't he?
Right.
And precocious for his age, to understand stigma and what it's like to speak about it. I mean, generally, boys externalize and girls internalize more. Those are broad statements, of course. And generally, right, it's more acceptable still for girls and women to express sadness and anxiety. And that's probably partly why the boys and men act out with anger and irritability, because it's less acceptable for them to show that side, which shows how our culture still devalues things that are feminine. Again, going back to, mothers and our childcare crisis. So we'll see those types of differences. And so we will see more stigma for boys and men to talk about these mental health struggles.
Dr. Christian, you work with many kids of color. What's weighing on them especially?
Right. And when you're asking about some of the demographic differences, one really big concern is the racial achievement gap that already existed in the United States, where children of color are often 1, 2, or more years behind their white peers. And that exists for a number of reasons, certainly because of segregation, because of discrimination and systemic racism. And unfortunately, that achievement gap may only increase secondary to COVID. There was recently a story in the Boston Globe that looked at DCF being called on certain families for kids who were not signing on to web-based learning. The majority, if not all of those calls, were for children of color, but 30% of kids statewide in Massachusetts were not signing on, but those calls were not being made for white families. So what we're seeing is that because of COVID, more children of color are losing family members, their families are losing income, but they are also continuing to experience the racial achievement gap, receiving less support, having more issues with disciplinary factors, even in the virtual setting. And so for multiple reasons, COVID-19 is disproportionately negatively impacting families of color.
I want to turn now to advice and resources that families can use to help their kids. And some of you have talked a little bit about this already. I also want to remind listeners, though, that we'd love to hear from you. Tell us how your own kids are doing right now, or if you're a student, a young person yourself, let us know how you're doing emotionally, how you're managing all the ups and downs of this past year. Our phone number here in the Exchange is 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. So Ritu, Erin mentioned, you know, the huge benefits of getting outside, getting that sunshine, you know, basic advice that we keep hearing again and again. In your coverage, Ritu, what strategies do you see families adopting to help their kids? You know, strategies, simple or complicated?
So I'll start with the one that really stayed with me, and this was part of a story I recently reported. And I was talking to both psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, pediatricians, parents, and they all seemed to say, you know, given just how stressful things are just now, like, make sure you find time and make room for family fun time. And I think Dr. Christian Brathwaite just alluded to that a little bit about kind of finding ways to have the kid engaged. But one of the things they said about planning family fun time is at this time when all our routines and structures have all gone awry, like, planning in some time to have fun with your kid does several things. A, like, you build that into your like weekly routine and gives the kid something to look forward to. And then when you do something together as a family, it addresses stress in everybody. It decreases stress in everybody, right? And creates the sense of cohesion within the family. And that alone buffers so much against stress and sort of is one of those sort of resiliency factors for families and kids. And then it's sort of when you're having fun, it becomes easier to talk to your kid about like, okay, what's going on with your life? How's school going? Not sort of like, tell me how things are going, but again, in a relaxed fashion. And it can also be room for parents to share, like, this is a tough time. I'm struggling too, but we're figuring it out as a family. So that was one thing that really stayed with me. Going outside, I think Erin mentioned that, and I think there's some preliminary research coming out of the Child Mind Institute in New York and NIMH. It's sort of the first set of findings from an ongoing study of parents and their kids that finds that kids that do go outside are coping much better. And then kids who have found ways to maintain some kind of social contact with friends where the parents are helping kids kind of plan, have a little bit of socialization, have a little bit of fun and social contact, kind of in a safe manner, you know, socially distantly outside, those kids are doing better. So those are sort of some of a handful of the strategies that families are using.
Yeah. And Ritu, I've definitely heard, you know, people talk about make room for family fun. And I have to say, like, early in the pandemic, it was Yeah, sure, we can do this. Now it's been almost a year. So I wonder, Ritu, you know, are some families' motivation to, yep, we got this, we can do it, is that kind of fading?
Oh, yeah.
You know, absolutely. We're all sick of jigsaw puzzles and family game night.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the other thing, I think initially, like, adults and children were like, okay, we're going to stay in touch with everybody on Zoom. And now everybody is Zoomed out, I'm hearing, right? And so one of the things I'm hearing pediatricians and child psychiatrists suggest is, like, if you are interacting with people on Zoom, like, don't do just sit and chat, like, plan an activity, like, cook together. I think Nicole mentioned, you know, let your child cook. Maybe, you know, you can have cousins or friends, like, be on Zoom while both sides cook together. So again, like, everybody's feeling that fatigue, but of course, you know, at least now there seems to be light at the end of the tunnel. And so it's a matter of just sort of finding a way to just
hold on a little bit longer. Yeah, it's not just, we are now sitting on Zoom, we are now having a conversation. You know, that's a lot of pressure for kids. And I mean, sometimes my kids just, they don't want to do that, you know? So yep. I appreciate what you're saying there, actually do something. Dr. Christian, what's your sort of general broad advice for parents who are concerned about their kids, and what resources are available?
Sure. So one of the biggest concerns, obviously, is safety. And I know many parents are often afraid of asking their kids if they've had unsafe thoughts or if they've experienced thoughts about not wanting to be here, because there's this fear that, oh, if I introduce this topic, maybe they'll have those thoughts. Our kids are introduced to these types of topics very early on, whether it's through their peers or social media. So it's better to be proactive than reactive. And when our kids are calm, or when we're taking a family walk or over dinner, those are the opportunities to really sit and have conversations with our kids. So as the wonderful kid governor mentioned, we have to normalize mental health. And when we're having conversations with our kids, acknowledging that this is a difficult time, letting them know that if they are having unsafe thoughts, if they are having thoughts of not wanting to be here or thoughts of hurting themselves, that they should come to their parents, that we should talk about it. There's no judgment, there's no consequence. The concern is just ensuring that they're healthy. The other important thing is to talk to our kids about how they express their stress and paying attention. When our kids are stressed, do they tend to isolate more? Are they sleeping more or less? Are they eating more or less? I'm hearing from parents that their kids have gained 20 pounds or they're not eating at all. And so really paying attention to these signs, because, you know, kids don't always use words to tell us how they feel. Sometimes we have to look at their behaviors. Sometimes we have to look at how they're engaging with their peers. And then again, I've noticed that you've been a little bit more irritable. I've noticed that you've been isolating more. Are you feeling sad? Are you feeling angry? And really equipping our kids with that emotional language so that they can begin to express themselves. And you can never go wrong with therapy. Frankly, everyone can benefit from therapy. But certainly, if you're noticing a decrease in the quality of your child's life, again, if there are any safety concerns at all, if you're noticing a significant decline in their schoolwork or peer interactions, then it's absolutely important and worth seeking out mental health supports. Often you can start with a pediatrician, seeing if they have any recommendations for referrals. You can also go through your insurance company to find a therapist or psychiatrist that accepts your insurance. There are also many 800 numbers for kids. The Good Samaritans has a free 800 number. They also have a Good Teen Samaritans for adolescents to call in. On my website, wellmindsconsulting.com, under resources, I have a document called COVID-19 Resources, and it's 5 or 6 pages of ideas and techniques and tips for parents, as well as websites and phone numbers.
Wow. And as always, we put those resources on our website as well. So there are links there and so forth. And ours is nhpr.org/exchange. So that's great. Erin, here in New Hampshire, we hear that it's extremely difficult to find a mental health professional for anybody, but especially kids. So Erin, what's your best advice for families in the meantime while they wait for that appointment?
Yeah, I mean, we have to rely on some natural supports. That's just, the reality we live in, there's still no parity for mental health. Our reimbursements are really low. I think we have one of the lowest Medicaid reimbursements in New Hampshire for children's mental health services in the country. Again, finding family members, finding if you don't have the wherewithal to be supportive to your child because of depression, anxiety, stress, you know, that's okay. This is unprecedented and we don't need to be perfect. But finding other natural supports, can grandma come, can grandma zoom in, auntie, friends, someone to continue to help out and reach out to your children. Again, I think we need to get schools. I can't say enough. We need to get schools open. They are just the bedrock for family life and child well-being and parent well-being. And luckily we have been able to do that. I know there are certain circumstances across the country where that, you know, is much harder. So getting them back into school, getting them back into routines, allowing some socialization that's outside, that's safe, especially as summer comes back around, right? And we can find simple coping skills. There are apps, there are sort of self-guided coping programs that take you through breathing, taking breaks when you're stressed. Some people like mindfulness. And so there are resources online that we can also use. And speaking of online, I was going to go back to one point about safety. We've seen a huge increase in internet safety problems. While kids are spending so much time on their phones and tablets and computers. And so Nicole was talking to children about their thoughts and their depression and self-harm. We have to be talking, as young as 7, 8, we have to be talking about internet sites, safe internet sites. We've seen a lot of pornography, a lot of inappropriate material coming through to these kids' eyes and ears, you know, more internet predators.
And that can be distressing too, right, Erin? So,
yeah,
you know, it doesn't make things better for sure.
Right. Social media, you know, the jury's in. Social media is bad for us. It can probably be used in good ways, but when we as parents go to reach for our phones and when our children go to reach for their phones, use them in ways that make you feel better, that connect you with another human, you know, rather in ways that make us feel worse, which typically social media does, and you know, other websites that are inappropriate.
Well, we have to take a very quick break. And we also have to say goodbye to Ritu now. I know you have to leave us. Ritu, thank you very much for your time. We'll talk again.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Ritu Chatterjee. She's health correspondent with NPR. A reminder to our listeners, we have lots of resources, including information that our guests have mentioned, on our web post for today. That's nhpr.org/exchange. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, more of your input at exchange@nhpr.org. Stay with us.
NHPR is live.
Historic event, and she joins us on the phone now for some reaction. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Rick.
Local.
Dartmouth College and the University of New Hampshire are planning in-person graduation ceremonies this year.
And listener-supported. And right now, when you support your source for community connection and quality journalism, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar by a generous group of NHPR donors. Double your impact right now. Give at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, help for New Hampshire renters and landlords as the pandemic continues to cause financial insecurity. Join us for that conversation tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, it's part 2 of our series, Taking a Toll, about the mental health impacts of the past year. And this hour, we're focusing on kids. Next week, we'll talk about elderly Granite Staters. Listeners, tell us how you see children doing right now, whether you're a parent, a teacher, someone who works with children. What stories or advice do you have for kids and families who might be struggling? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook or you can give us a call, 800-892-6477. We're talking with Erin Barnett, an assistant professor of psychiatry who sees patients at West Central Behavioral Health in Lebanon, and Dr. Nicole Christian Brathwaite, a psychiatrist and the CEO of and founder of Well Minds Consulting in Boston. And both of you, right back to our listeners. And Reeves calling from Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in today.
Hi there. My comment is that, and a recommendation is, first of all, a caller you had earlier, Lindsay, was just brilliant, stating that we needed so much to teach children very early all about their feelings, and it's all normal and all wonderful. But the recommendation I wanted to make, I'm a movement educator, and I work with people's bodies and emotions through their bodies and their stress levels. And one of the most wonderful books I've read that I think would be great for both kids and parents is called Breath by James Nestor. It's about breathing, called Breath. And it is until the 1950s, when we got pharma offering us anti-anxiety meds and so forth, people were taught that almost the inverse of what we think of breathing as right today would actually relieve anxieties and depressions. It's a fascinating book, and I also think because it is so hilarious in spots, the author puts himself through some hysterical exercises, but the whole family might read it aloud together and learn all these incredibly simple basics that have been known for thousands of years to calm and ease yourself. So Breath by Nestor, I would say everyone should read it and laugh and learn.
Wow. Okay, Reeve, thank you very much for calling in. I really appreciate that. And wow, Dr. Christian, what do you think? A friend of mine read this book and I said, really? A whole book about breathing? And he said, oh yeah. And it's, believe me, it's there's a lot in there. What do you think, Dr. Christian?
So that's a great recommendation. And there's tremendous research supporting using mindfulness to manage stress and to manage anxiety. There have even been studies utilizing mindfulness practices in school environments. And when I say mindfulness, it really just means being present, being in the moment. I often encourage families to take mindful walks, meaning when you're walking outside with your kids, use your five senses. Don't just walk, you know, without thinking and not focusing on the environment, but what do you smell? What do you see? What do you taste? How does it feel? And in schools, whether or not it's just deep breathing for 30 seconds or 3 minutes, doing some yoga or stretching, any of those types of activities that really bring you into the present, so you're not worried about yesterday or feeling anxious about tomorrow, but you're really focusing on the present and deep breathing. It's been shown to improve academic performance in kids. It even has been shown to improve standardized test scores. It decreases school violence and school discipline, like suspensions or expulsions. And so both at home and in the school environment, if we are able to incorporate mindfulness or deep breathing into our daily lives, it can actually be quite effective. And I think we often assume, well, what will breathing do or what will deep breathing do? But there's so much research to support it. And I even encourage my kids to mindfully eat, meaning smell your food, taste your food, chew it before you swallow. And that just helps our kids and helps us to enjoy our food and to
slow down
and be present in the moment.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you there, Dr. Christian. Your line went out for just a moment, but the book Breath by James Nestor, and we'll put that information on our website as well. We've got another caller. This is Eric from Nashua. Go ahead, Eric. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. How are you guys doing? In the light and spirit of leaving no child behind in representation and in the best interest of the children, I was seeing if I could get the experts to opine on a cultural issue with law enforcement families that are experiencing critical mass in domestic violence rates at 40% and increased suicide rates at 3 times the average rate. And those children are obviously being affected. And what could be done or what is being done to combine the science of child's emotional well-being in those families? And how would you suggest to those families that they speak about that when law enforcement themselves has not modeled good behavior in speaking about that?
Eric, I'm so glad you called. And Aaron, I'll throw that to you. Law enforcement, suicides, stress in those families. Thank you so much for calling, Aaron. Go ahead, Aaron. Thank you. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah. And what, you know, an irony that we're relying on emergency and law enforcement to help us through crises. And yet they have some pretty high rates of struggling with mental health themselves, right? And aggression and some other, not all of them, of course, we don't want to stigmatize. It puts the kids in a pretty big bind. when the family member, the parent, is sort of is in some eyes a hero, in some eyes supposed to be the safe person, and even that's changing in how we as a society view law enforcement, and I want to acknowledge that. But what a bind that then they, as the children, feel, feel the effects of the violence within their own homes, right? And the violence or the abuse they may be receiving. And it's a culture shift. It's a culture shift within law enforcement, you know, traditionally growing out of that sort of ultra masculine aggressive culture that I think is bred, also tons of substance use bred into sometimes into emergency responders, law enforcement. And that's gonna come from leadership, top down and bottom up. So top down justice leadership and bottom up community coalitions to really look carefully with law enforcement as our partners, as our friends, as our neighbors, as our community members, to solve not only that sort of that struggle with this hyper masculine aggressive kind of approach, but the other struggles that we've seen obviously in our country with racial justice in the last that have been highlighted in the last year. So a culture shift in terms of the children, again, it's about making them feel safe to talk about this, and they may not be safe in their homes to talk about it. So other, going back full circle to schools, coaches, child protection, pediatricians, there's no health without mental health. So we all need to understand mental health. We all need to understand social emotional learning to give these children some validation, some empathy, and some outlets.
Wow. Eric, I'm really glad that you called. And his call also reminds me of something that came up in our Taking a Toll show last week, Dr. Christian. We had a Black woman on who's a therapist and who sees lots of patients of color. And she said, my normal advice for people when they're feeling stressed, you know, basic advice while you're waiting to see a therapist or whatever, is get outside, get some fresh air. But she said, many of my Black patients say, I don't feel safe, you know, going for a run, going for a walk in certain neighborhoods. So I wonder if you can address that, Dr. Christian.
Sure. I think for many groups, even referencing police officers, first responders, healthcare workers, and people of color are all experiencing trauma in different ways. And I think one of the most important things we have to recognize is that this year has been incredibly traumatic for many groups. And we have to respond and address these issues as if people are experiencing PTSD, because many people are displaying PTSD-like symptoms. But thinking about our people of color, our patients of color, particularly Black and Latino patients, this year has been exquisitely difficult over the last 2 years because they're dealing with the pandemic, losing family members at a much higher rate, dealing with financial struggles. Many Black women are the highest group in terms of people who have lost work or who are currently unemployed and are often the last people to be re-employed. And then if you live in a community where there aren't a lot of green spaces or there aren't really opportunities or places where you can safely play, that may be difficult to take that advice of just going for a walk. Or if you feel like your community is over-policed and you don't feel safe going for a run. I remember after Ahmaud Arbery was killed and my husband talked about going for a run, I felt significant anxiety. I was concerned about his safety. And so there's so much trauma and so much pain being experienced even outside of the direct impact of COVID in people of color.
We got an email from Carol who says, Amaskeag Health Center provides mental health clinicians in 2 elementary schools, Beach Street and Gosler Park, and all of the middle schools and high schools in Manchester. Carol, thank you so much for emailing. And again, as I've been saying, all of the resources that have come up during the show and that the exchange has pulled together are on our website today. Again, it's nhpr.org/exchange. You know, Erin, I did want to ask you, what about some of the long-term, possibly, you tell me, positive mental health aspects of all this, like resilience, like kindness, like gratitude. I am not sugarcoating in any way the struggles, but I wonder if some kids might come out of this stronger.
Well, we know that that could happen, and it depends on whether their systems and capacities are overwhelmed by the trauma after trauma after stress after stress after stress, or whether they have something to buffer them. So those are the two hinges, right? So if there's something, a caregiver usually, to buffer them from stress after stress after stress, they can come out more resilient and be proud of what they've gone through. And or if the stress and trauma aren't forever, if they're acute, if they stop. We can see some resiliency. We can see some creativity for children and families that may pop up. We can understand education systems that are more tailored and individualized, potentially, allow for more creativity in our education. Again, the huge positivity of telehealth that might arise from this pandemic, that's, you know, a big positive. And yeah, acknowledging our heroes, our healthcare, frontline workers, teachers. I think people have more gratitude for teachers and paras and educators than we ever have.
Right.
So there's definitely some growth that can happen.
Well, both of you, this has been great, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Erin, it was good to talk to you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Erin Barnett, assistant professor of psychiatry at the Geisel School of Medicine. She works for Dartmouth Hitchcock and also sees patients at West Central Behavioral Health. Dr. Krishnan, it was great to have you back. Thank you also for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Dr. Nicole Christian Brathwaite, a psychiatrist and CEO and founder of Well Minds Consulting Company. A reminder again, all the resources that were mentioned this hour are on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Our series, Taking a Toll, is produced by Jane Vaughn. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.